Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On this Politics Monday, we take a look at something we've all been inundated with in recent months on TV, on commercial radio, on our phones. Political advertising. It happens every political season, but what impact does it really have? We'll turn to that in a moment. First, Hurricane Helene smashed into the southeast on Friday and left devastation in her wake. As of yesterday, it was reported that in Buncombe County, home to Asheville, more than 1,000 people were unaccounted for, and more than 30 had already been confirmed dead. And according to Buncombe County Sheriff Quinton Miller, conditions there are making it almost impossible to reach the stranded due to collapsed roads, failing infrastructure, and widespread flooding. All through the mountains, severe damage and rampaging floodwaters were reported, and there was additional flooding, down trees and power outages all the way to Charlotte. WFAE's climate reporter Zach Turner is with us for this first part of the program. He's been out reporting on this all weekend and joins us now for an update. And we're also joined by former WFAE reporter Duncan McFadden. He is now a freelance reporter living in Linville, and Avery County, the home of Linville, is one of the hardest hit counties in the mountains. Good morning to both of you. Thank you for being here. Good morning, Mike. At a press briefing yesterday, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper summed up the storm this way.
This unprecedented storm dropped from 10 to 29 inches of rain across the mountains, causing life-threatening floods and landslides.
As I mentioned, that the death toll as of late yesterday in Buncombe County stood at 30. Zach, do we have a statewide count this morning, or has that number changed?
I haven't been able to get any updated figures from that, so I think the governor's answer is the most updated I've seen.
So give us an update on the 1,000 people in Buncombe County who are unaccounted for. I mean, roads are impassable, cell service is down, power and landline phones are for the most part out of commission. Is that the reason that we have all these unaccounted for people? Might they be accounted for when that service is restored or when people get to the areas that they currently can't get to?
Yeah, I mean, talking to a lot of folks that have been trying to reach loved ones that are in these areas, I mean, it's a total black box. You can only get a few messages in and out when people are able to get to cell service, and it's extremely limited. There are a few areas that have Wi-Fi. And in fact, our sister station, Blue Ridge Public Radio, they've been doing a great job of keeping track of these Wi-Fi hotspots for residents in Buncombe County where you can still go and access communications and get messages out. But yeah, for the most part, it's extremely difficult for folks to get any sort of communications out of Buncombe County in the surrounding counties in western North Carolina. It's also difficult to access it by road. So many of those roads are flooded, and the roads that are accessible, police are now turning folks away, trying to keep people from going into western North Carolina and give search and rescue teams more breathing room to conduct these operations to go searching for people. Another factor here is so many of these communities are extremely isolated. So, you know, it's not like, you know, these large suburban areas, there's not as much connectivity, and you have to go pretty far out of your way in some cases to go check on folks who are up in the mountains, who are up these like long and winding dirt roads. And so that's part of the reason is that it's incredibly difficult to reach everybody in these mountain communities.
Duncan, you're speaking to us this morning from Linville, and cell phone communication and all communication is a challenge in the mountains right now. So how are you speaking? How are you joining us?
My father was able to drive a Starlink device up here, a satellite internet device, yesterday. Zach is exactly right. Communications have been absolutely terrible. There was one hotspot in Avery County that I was able to get to. It was at the Cannon Memorial Hospital. And even they lost internet yesterday morning. So I had my father in a truck on the way up here, and I was using my iPhone to send satellite messages just to try to figure out how to coordinate with him. And everyone is feeling that frustration. People can't get in touch with loved ones in this area, in Asheville, anywhere.
And locate Linville for people who don't know where it is, who may be listening to us right now. It's kind of, if I'm right about this, kind of southwest of Boone. Would that be accurate?
That's exactly right. Most people know Grandfather Mountain. That's the most notable tourist attraction in Linville. And I'm sort of at the foot of the southwest face of that. And that's where the Linville Town Center is.
Governor Roy Cooper yesterday noted that the aftermath of this storm will be even more challenging for residents and government officials, but that the state and FEMA is doing everything they can as quickly as they can to bring help to the mountains.
People are desperate for help, and we are pushing to get it to them, a massive effort. Many people are cut off because roads are impassable. They don't have power or communications. Please know that we are sending resources and coordinating closely with local governments, first responders, state and federal partners, and volunteer organizations to help those impacted by this tragic storm.
And yet, Zachary, I suppose people are anxious and they are frustrated, but I heard lots of reports yesterday by people in the mountains on television reports that they are very frustrated at the fact that FEMA does not have a big presence on the ground, particularly in the Asheville area. Why is that? And is that true?
I mean, from what I've heard from talking to folks who have been speaking to their loved ones in Buncombe County, in Asheville, that is true. And that's exactly how they feel. There is a sense of abandonment in these communities. I think due to the widespread nature of a lot of this damage, I think resources are spread especially thin. I know county resources, when I was traveling through Rutherford County, a little ways west of Charlotte, that that's exactly what I was hearing from folks regarding their own police staff. They had instigated, they had instilled this curfew. So folks were supposed to be back at their homes by 7:30 p.m., but police were not able to enforce this necessarily because they were so busy running around the county checking on folks. And resources are spread incredibly thin, not just at the county level, but at the state, and it seems like federal level as well.
I know that they are airdropping some supplies, water, food, etc., in because roads are impassable. And we've been told that officials have been warning every road in western North Carolina should be considered dangerous because of extreme flood conditions in those areas. Could that be hampering access for FEMA?
I mean, absolutely. I think that's definitely a factor. That's why you're seeing people airdrop these supplies in there. If you just driving through the roads, even as far east as Rutherfordton, as Shelby, as Morganton, you're seeing down power lines. You're seeing roads that are still closed due to these down power lines. You're seeing trees that are pushing up against them and like dragging these lines into the road. You can see evidence of where there had been landslides and where roads have been washed over with mud and other debris. So it's incredibly hazardous out there just for anyone to be driving. And I imagine that is a big factor in terms of getting resources to these areas. And that is a big reason why you have police and county officials turning folks away, that if it's not necessary travel heading west, they're trying to create as much space on these roads to get emergency supplies to those areas.
As a programming note, Governor Cooper will hold a press conference about all this, an update at 2 p.m. this afternoon, and we will carry it live here on WFAE and WFHE in Hickory. You are speaking to us, Duncan, this morning in Linville. I'm told you told one of our producers, Sarah D'Elia, that one of the other challenges in the mountains is that there are a lot of people there right now because they've gone up to the mountains to see the leaves change. Is that putting strain on what limited resources?
Well, yes. Any extra people who especially don't know the area put an additional strain on resources. But yeah, normally this area is packed with people for about 5 weeks from the end of September through the beginning of November. And aside from the fact that all of the people who live here who rely on the tourism economy for income, the impact that it'll have on them, I know personally people who were up here visiting the Banner Elk area from Raleigh and got stranded and fortunately had a four-wheel drive to take back roads, but had a very harrowing time getting out of here. And I would imagine that there are dozens, if not hundreds, of vacationers who don't have communications and don't know the back roads to get out of the mountain.
When Hurricane Hugo came through Charlotte in the 80s, one of the things that we learned was that we didn't understand exactly what hurricanes can do. And so a lot of people were not prepared, and we were out of power in certain areas in Charlotte for 3 weeks. Would it be safe to say that many of the people up in the mountains who don't go to the mountains very often, they just go for vacations or to watch the leaves change, Duncan, did not understand what was about to hit them? In fact, many residents perhaps didn't understand what was about
to hit them. Mike, I'm from Wilmington. I've lived through every hurricane there since Diana in 1985. That's one of my earliest memories. I wasn't prepared. I drove in from Asheville on Wednesday night in the torrent, and I saw mudslides on 221 coming north into the Linville area. Then I did go get some more supplies Thursday when I was able to, but I was not prepared. My dad had to bring me food and water. The grocery stores will be closed for a long time. The Ingles in Newland is totally flooded. The Lowe's in Banner Elk is closed indefinitely. So he was my lifeline for food and my ability to stay here and continue to try to tell this story.
The Swannanoa fire chief reported yesterday that part of Old Highway 70, it's the main corridor of Swannanoa and the neighboring town of Black Mountain, is not here anymore, and that whole neighborhoods have been wiped out. How bad were the other mountain areas surrounding the Asheville area, Zach, impacted by this?
It really depends on elevation. I was talking to somebody whose family is in Silva, North Carolina, and I think they're at a little bit of a higher elevation. While they've been completely out of cell service, while they have, had difficulty with power, in terms of actual flooding damage and stuff like that, it's been a little bit better for them. And it really depends town by town. So it's not like every town has not been hit the exact same way. It is extremely variable. And what's really interesting to hear is just like how communication between these towns has changed after the last few days. People are not able to, they don't have an understanding necessarily of even what's going on in the town right next to them, just 10 miles down the road driving around. And in some cases, they're relying on their relatives who are outside of Western North Carolina to give them information about if they're in Silva, if they're in Canton, what is going on in Asheville, what is going on even as far east as Morganton and some of these other cities.
Duncan, did you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, Mike, Zach touched on something that is important. There is not standing flood water in Avery County. I'm at 3,700 feet and I'm along the river. I can see the Linville River out my back window. It's changed positions in the last 72 hours, but I can see it. The higher homes here are owned by wealthy vacationers for the most part. And most people who live here year round live closer to the waterways. And the water just blew through here and has now rushed downstream to the Catawba River in the Linville River's case, into the Gorge and other places into Asheville, and it's now standing there. Asheville is around 2,300 feet in elevation, I think. So that's important to note. We have the damage from the water, but not water at the higher elevations.
So, Duncan, you are in Linville, which is near Boone. Boone suffered greatly in this storm. Here's Boone Mayor Tim Fittrell.
Never thought I'd see a river running down King Street, but unfortunately that is exactly what we saw. And just thinking a lot about our small business owners and our folks that are the backbone of our community that help keep us thriving, we're going to need a lot of help to support them as well to recover and rebuild.
I have 30 seconds. Do we know what the situation in Boone is this morning, Zach or Duncan?
I know that App State is closed until October 4th. They've set up a temporary shelter at the Convocation Center there. If it's pet friendly. If any students happen to hear this, there is some 90.7 signal up here. There's a shelter there. Beyond that, I don't know.
Well, when we come back very quickly, we're going to hit to the need for food and water and why the cell service was so badly damaged in the mountains of North Carolina by this storm in just a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. The Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE in Hickory. I'm Mike Collins. It's Politics Monday. We're going to get into the impact of and the effectiveness of political advertising in a moment, which was the topic for today. But because of the extraordinary impact of Hurricane Helene and the lives lost in that area and the infrastructure loss, we want to spend some time getting an update as best we can on what's going on in western North Carolina, where 30 people in Buncombe County alone are reported dead. And CNN reports this morning that 36 of the 95 confirmed deaths from this storm are from North Carolina. Yesterday, there were 280 state-maintained roads closed, the majority of them in Henderson, Ashe, Buncombe, Lincoln, Cleveland, Jackson, Transylvania, and Yancey County. I-40 was closed near the Tennessee border, where part of the highway washed out. This, of course, is hampering efforts to get help and food and water to places. And Zach, you reported yesterday, I should say, that Zachary Turner, our climate reporter, is with us, along with Duncan McFadden, a former WFAE reporter now working freelance in Linville, is also with us. But Zach, you reported yesterday that people started heading east for supplies when some of those roads began opening up.
Absolutely. I started heading down, it was Interstate 74, I believe, going through Shelby. And on the way heading east, you could see there was just a massive line of traffic as people were heading. Anyone that could get out of Asheville, anyone that could get out of Chimney Rock, Lake Lure, these places that had been completely flooded, they were heading east to get access to power, to get access to food. I saw people at the Dollar Tree in Shelby who were standing outside charging their phone. Even there, they didn't have access to power and were having to come out there to get access to energy to charge their phones and also get water and other supplies. The Dollar Tree had also run out of water. And as far
Water is a major concern because a lot of the municipal water systems in places like Asheville were inundated. What's the damage? What's the cause of that? Did water simply run too quickly into the reservoirs and they can't, or the power is out to the treatment plants? What's the problem with the municipal water systems? Do we know?
That I'm not too sure. I mean, this is a pretty unprecedented volume of water that is moving through these communities. I was checking a USGS rain gauge for the second Broad River. This is a river that's normally about 2 feet deep, and it leapt up to over 20 feet. So when you're talking about whether or not anybody, even if you formerly lived in Wilmington, could have been prepared for this, I don't think anyone's ready to see a 2 foot, you know, deep stream jump up about 18 feet.
Governor Cooper, in that cut that we played earlier in the program, mentioned that feeding stations have been set up along with shelters for those who have lost their homes. And a lot of people are handing out water, churches, even Harris Teeter and other grocery stores are handing out free water. But because many roads are impassable, airlifting of supplies has already begun. And a lot of people have no communication. So do they know where to go for these supplies of water and food? Duncan,
Duncan might be able to answer this too. But I imagine in many cases they don't, unless they have access to internet and can get on social media and maybe connect with organizations like Blue Ridge Public Radio and other organizations that are disseminating that information.
Zach?
Radio is Duncan? Probably the best way that information is getting out.
Okay. Late yesterday, Buncombe County Manager Avril Pinder said that there was no food or water distribution plan yet in place. And she said, my promise to you is that we are really close. That's in Buncombe County, home to Asheville. Are they any closer to that this morning, Zach?
Again, not entirely sure. I do know that there have been some organizations that have been stepping up in order to get resources out to the community. So you have Manna Food Bank in Asheville. You have the Asheville Buncombe Community Christian Ministry, Homeward Bound. I know the American Red Cross is organizing efforts out there. So to Duncan's point, if there is anybody listening and has, like, you know, is looking for resources or looking to get in contact, either you're on the outside and you want to get resources to Buncombe County, those are some organizations that have started trying to channel resources there. Also, if you're on the inside and you're looking for places to go get access to those food and water resources, those might be some possible locations to check out.
Cell service is out in many wide swaths of areas in the mountains. In Canton, Mayor Zeb Smathers says the lack of cellular communication is heartbreaking and unacceptable, adding, you're not going to tell me that there weren't things that could have been done better. Duncan, you're speaking to us on a satellite hookup that your father provided. why is cell service down? Is it that the towers went down? Is it that the fiber that connects the towers to the main system was severed? What's the reason for it? Do we know?
My understanding is a combination of lack of energy to power the towers, and in some cases, the connections have been severed. I'm not sure which one is a greater problem at this point, but cell service is very, very bad.
As we discovered in Hurricane Hugo here in Charlotte, people came together. It was everybody helping everybody, holding cookouts in neighborhoods because there was no power and they had to use the food up before it went bad. And you say, Duncan, that people are looking for ways in your area to help each other. What are they doing?
Well, I'm going to try to tie two things together here, Mike. I want to add that most people here have well water. If they don't have electricity, they can't get water out of the well. So people here are having to go to the creeks to get water to bathe in and flush toilets, wash their dishes. And drinking water is very scarce. So one of the ways that people are helping is if a business has resources, the ability to cook on gas and some bottles of water and some drinks, they're putting the word out that they're cooking, and the community sort of moves from business to business, getting a hot meal and getting more water. There's a construction company. One of the folks lives in my neighborhood, and his house has been sort of a staging area. They're going and checking on people who haven't been found and trying to get supplies into these harder hit areas where roads are completely washed out. Banner Elk and Beach Mountain in particular are nearly inaccessible, and there are helicopters flying overhead, airlifting people out to hospitals.
Zach, I want to wrap this up in this way, because you are our climate reporter, and we are seeing more and more and more. It's almost every week we see never before seen storms piling up and dumping loads of water and causing incredible amounts of damage. Are people beginning to connect the dots between these storms and climate change and the human contribution to that, to such an extent where they might begin to demand political action?
I don't know if people are necessarily connecting it to climate change in this situation. The people that I've talked to, I haven't necessarily been, you know, beating people over the head with that at this particular point in time when I've been talking to them. But I'm happy to make that connection now in terms of talking about what are some of the factors in which climate change has maybe impacted Hurricane Helene as it was coming and impacting North Carolina. We know that fossil fuel combustion has warmed our atmosphere by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit already, which provides more. When the atmosphere gets warmer, it can hold more moisture. That's giving these storms a little bit more ammunition in terms of water, in terms of precipitation, which is a lot of what is causing such extreme flooding in Western North Carolina. We also, another big factor is that this hurricane intensified very rapidly, you know, once it hit the Gulf Coast. So it's getting more energy from these warm ocean waters. It's drawing that energy, and that's causing it to intensify extremely quickly over a 24-hour period. And this makes it very difficult to forecast. And that was a big part of what I've been hearing from people, is just how unexpected this was. People do not feel prepared. And as a result, they're feeling angry and they're feeling scared. And there's a lot of, you know, the sense of like, nothing prepared me for how bad this was going to be.
Zach Turner is WFAE's climate reporter. Duncan McFadden, a former WFAE reporter with us, working freelance now and living in Linville. Duncan, thank you for joining us this morning, and stay safe because you're in the heart of it all. The worst hit county in the area, evidently, is Avery County. So stay safe. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Zach, as well. A reminder that Governor Roy Cooper will hold a press conference about this, an update on what's going on in the western part of Carolina at 2 p.m. this afternoon, and we will carry it live on WFAE. Now, on to the topic for this Politics Monday, political advertising. Candidates and PACs deluge us every election season with an onslaught of ads on every platform except public radio. Some of these ads are informational, but many, if not most, are highly negative and focused on that candidate's opponent. We wondered which style of ad was more effective. We wondered if, given the sheer number of these ads, any of them are effective, or do we just tune them out? We wondered if these ads change any minds and lead to victory or defeat, or are we also now firmly entrenched with our political beliefs that nothing can move us a fraction of an inch. Joining us to help us figure all that out is WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Susan Roberts is with us, professor of political science at Davidson College. She teaches a class on campaign finance or campaign strategy, excuse me. And Michael Franz is co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks and analyzes advertising by federal and gubernatorial candidates in real time during elections. He's also professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. Thank you all three for being with us. Steve, I want to start with you. The situation in the mountains right now, will this have any impact at all, do you know, on voting on election day or early voting? Because the absentee ballots have already gone out. Mail obviously has been disrupted in those areas. Do you see any impact from this storm at all on elections?
Yeah, Mike, I would think there has the potential to be a big impact. In-person early voting starts on October 17th. Let's assume that the impacted counties are kind of able to get all of their early voting sites up and running. You know, I think you're going to have a lot of people who may have left. I mean, not left. You know, they've just left temporarily. They may not be here to vote. Other people may have things on their mind, you know, in terms of like repairing their home and getting their life back together. So I think there's a huge potential for this to not disrupt the running of the election, but to impact the result of the election. I think this is going to be a huge story to watch moving forward.
Susan, we just heard from our political reporter, our climate reporter, excuse me, Zach Turner, about people being angry and scared because of this storm, and they felt unprepared. And even the mayor of one of the towns in the mountains said, surely we saw this coming. Surely we could have done something to harden the cellular communications. It didn't happen. What impact might that have, this anger and frustration, on how people vote, either in the gubernatorial race or for their local congressional races or for the presidential contest, do you think? Unmute yourself. Susan, unmute yourself. Hit the space bar.
Okay, you got it. I was listening to the other. Well, you mentioned something about what was going on in the mountains, and you mentioned one word that's important for, political action committees and other ads. It introduces uncertainty, and people don't like to live with uncertainty. And I think that the climate is just perfect for an increase in negative ads, the increase in polarization, the increase in partisan antipathy, and real differences in the issues. And I think that this sort of thing in the mountains is going to take the focus away from the campaign and from the election. And, you don't want it necessarily to take it away. Television is the only medium, but it's still a primary medium. And this is important. Pew Research Center said that 90% of Americans are very exhausted or somewhat exhausted from politics, and that 89% of Americans are somewhat or very angry. And so the climate, and that's really a bedrock about what's going to happen in terms of political communication.
Anger. So if they're very angry about this storm and the lack of preparedness or the seeming lack of preparedness, could that change votes?
Well, I'm not sure that they're going to make the leap from what happened up there to climate change and ads, but I think it could have an impact, as Steve said, on polling places, uncertainty. Where do I go? Who can work at those places? And I think it may delay their thinking on this. And just like Trump and the Democratic National Convention, the spotlight was off him. He didn't like that. The spotlight will be off on both candidates and the election, to me, undoubtedly.
So we're here to talk about political advertising, and the storm sidetracked us. But Michael Franz is with us from the Wesleyan Media Project that studies all of this. How does this year's crop of political ads, because I know you cover both the presidential campaigns and gubernatorial campaigns, how does it compare with previous years? Are more of them negative, or is it about the same?
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. So if you're looking at the presidential race, for example, it's very negative campaign. Donald Trump is running almost exclusively negative ads, presumably under the assumption that, Harris, the opinion of Harris is more movable than opinion of himself. Kamala Harris, on the other hand, is running a fair number of positive messages across the country to try to introduce herself to voters and get people to engage with her campaign. And she's avoiding a lot of negative ads that attack Trump instead of doing more contrast spots with her and Trump. And so the idea that you could move people's opinions of Trump, I think, has moved her to kind of put as much as she can the focus on herself.
If you have a good negative ad, it can make a difference, because the George H.W. Bush, Willie Horton ad certainly had an impact in the race with Michael Dukakis, the Democrat. Ronald Reagan's Morning in America spot certainly had an impact on his contest with Jimmy Carter. Do negative ads still move the needle, or have we gotten to the point in our politics, inside and outside of political season, that we already believe what we believe and we don't care what you say, positive or negative? Michael.
I mean, my sense of things is that it can be both of those, in the sense that almost everybody or a large portion of the electorate is not movable, and already forms very strong opinions about how they're gonna vote. However, elections are extremely close and come down to very, very tiny shares of the electorate in battleground states in these presidential races. And that's the margin that you're trying to tweak. And so these messages are in part about mobilizing your supporters to vote, but they're also about just winning that tiny slice when the whole ball game is about that.
So, Susan, I know you want to chime in on this, but this is going to be a contest about turnout. Whoever turns the most voters out is going to win this. So do negative ads get people to turn out because they want to vote against that son of a gun? Or do they do positive ads turn out because they want to vote for that nice person?
Well, some of the research on turnout is kind of mixed. Does it increase turnout? Does it decrease turnout? But as Michael pointed out, I mean, there's that holy trinity of elections: register, persuade, and mobilize. And I think we're in the mobilization phase because, and that's directed to constituencies. If you are a hardcore MAGA supporter, there's nothing to persuade you. There's probably nothing to mobilize you. You've got to look for those undecided and that slim margin. So I think that turnout is a question. But one thing that's a consequence of negative ads is it doesn't just, and this is the climate, it doesn't just elect an individual. It contributes to a lack of trust in government, uglier political rhetoric, lack of trust in institutions. And if we look at the bigger picture, that's not just elections, but negative ads are very damning in so many ways.
Steve, very quickly.
I just was going to say you look at, question whether they work or not. I think if you look close at home in the governor's race in North Carolina, Mark Robinson was trailing Josh Stein a little bit back in the spring. But then the negative ads started on Robinson and he has been falling further and further behind.
They're still spending a lot of money on these ads. We'll talk about that and ad placement, what matters these days, in when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison, our WFAE political reporter, is with us along with Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, and Michael Franz, co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project, professor of government and legal studies at Bowdoin College in Maine. We're talking about the effectiveness of political advertising. Steve, they spent a lot of money every year on this. Miami Herald reports that Donald Trump's campaign recently spent over $37 million in just one day in seven key states, while Harris's campaign launched a $90 million TV advertising blitz to air over 3 weeks in seven battleground states. How much money is going into this campaign in North Carolina?
I don't have the exact figures for North Carolina in front of me, but one interesting thing about North Carolina and Charlotte is that it's one of the few places where the Trump campaign is running close to parity with Kamala Harris. He is being outspent by her in almost all of the other swing states significantly. Here, if you watch TV and look at the numbers, it's a pretty 50-50 split in terms of who's up on the airwaves. So, and I think that shows that for the Harris campaign, North Carolina is, it's one of their lowest priority states. And for the Trump campaign, it's an absolutely must win.
What about the gubernatorial race?
on, you know, the Josh Stein's campaign is absolutely dominating in terms of spending, and will be even more so because the Republican Governors Association has called it quits on Mark Robinson's campaign. Mark Robinson will not be able to raise any more money. So basically his campaign in terms of being on the airwaves is, I think, basically over. And, you know, now we'll see how much more the Democrats and Stein's campaign kind of work to drive Robinson into the ground. And, you know, that'll be the big thing moving forward.
Michael, whether it's the race for president or for governor, TV advertising used to be king. Yeah, there were radio ads, but television was where the big money was spent. And today, a lot of young people don't watch television. They don't watch commercial television. They get their news from other sources. They watch memes on their phones, etc. Are online platforms equally effective in political advertising as compared to television and radio, traditional media? Michael.
That's a great question, and I don't know if we know the answer. So I think that you still see a tremendous amount of TV spots in traditional television, local news during game shows and talk shows, because the audience for those ads tends to skew a little older, and they tend to be very reliable voters. The audience for the online messages would skew a little bit younger, and younger turnout is notoriously lower. So it's a little hard to know if the effect of those messages in getting people to vote is as big as maybe the campaigns think it is.
You can run television ads. You can run ads on people's phones, on the various platforms we get on our phones. Are they as effective, Michael, as some of these memes that circulate that are created by ordinary individuals and they just go viral? Or the fact that late night television monologues, which skewer politicians left and right, get chopped up and stuck on these various platforms, and that's how they get out. People don't watch them live on television anymore. They watch them on their phones. Are these as effective, more effective, less effective than advertising?
Well, I mean, those memes and other sorts of things that are shared through comedic outlets and so forth tend to not contain much information, and so they probably contribute already to people's pre-existing senses of the candidates. The ads themselves, you know, sometimes online, whether you see it before a YouTube clip or if you see it in a Facebook feed and there's a video, might contain some information from the campaign or from an outside group that could help you make a decision about which candidate to support or could compel you to contribute. An ad online that contains a link to a fundraising platform's going to be way more effective than a meme if you can just get someone to click on that link and contribute some money. So I think it remains to be seen sort of the balance there, but campaigns probably think the bang for the buck of these online messages is still worth the effort.
Susan Roberts, there's a strategy to all this, believe it or not. That's what they pay these campaign at media consultants big bucks for. But when we don't know whether online platform ads are as effective, more effective, less effective than television, and if we don't know, and we don't, exactly what kind of a message is most effective, even in traditional media, how do you strategize? Is it just a shot in the dark?
No, I don't think so. And I think the biggest strategy is micro-targeting. You want your audience, you don't want full participation. You want your constituencies to turn out. And I think that I'm looking forward to dissecting in Michael well the other things that are going to happen in 2024. I don't know what the influencer campaigns are going to do. I don't know what generative AI is going to do. I don't know what having better micro-targeting is going to do. There are a lot of things that make it difficult, at least to me, to predict how these last, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, however many weeks, not many weeks, are going to play out.
How does the campaign decide whether they're best served with a negative ad or negative ads against the other person versus here I am and here's why I'm great? How do they make that decision, Susan?
Well, I think the old adage, if they didn't work, they wouldn't use them. And I think it's very nuanced and it's a finely tuned craft. And I think they have to look at the backlash they could get. I mean, one of the things that I think we should mention is a famous negative ad was Jesse Helms in 1990, where he crumbled up a piece of paper, a white hand crumbled up a piece of paper against affirmative action, and it had very decided racial overtones. And that was effective.
Let me play a couple of negative ads from this current campaign. The first is from the Kamala Harris campaign.
In 2016, Donald Trump said he would choose only the best people to work in his White House. Now those people have a warning for America. Trump is not fit to be president again. Here's his vice president.
Anyone who puts themselves over the Constitution should never be president of the United States.
It should come as no surprise that I will not be endorsing Donald Trump this year.
His defense secretary.
Do you think Trump can be trusted with the nation's secrets ever again?
No. I mean, it's just irresponsible action that places our service members at risk, places our nation's security at risk.
His national security advisor.
Donald Trump will cause a lot of damage. The only thing he cares about is Donald Trump.
And the nation's highest ranking military officer.
We don't take an oath to a king or a queen or to a tyrant or a dictator. And we don't take an oath to a wannabe dictator.
Take it from the people who knew him best. Donald Trump is a danger to our troops and our democracy. We can't let him lead our country again.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
Okay, so before we hear from the Trump campaign and their negative ad, talk about this approach, Michael. This ad features Republicans who have changed their minds about Donald Trump, but will it change the minds of Trump followers? And isn't that key?
Well, it probably won't change the mind of Trump followers, but it might convince independent-leaning Republicans to go with Harris. It might convince those swing voters, those undecided voters, who are worried about the economy to give a second thought to voting for Donald Trump. And in this message in particular, the messenger is the key. If Harris had said those things, it wouldn't have as much of an impact as former Republicans saying those things. So this is really about getting those center-right, independent conservatives to give second thought about Trump.
Well, that answers my next question, but I'll ask it anyway, Susan, because this ad features all of these people. It doesn't even mention visually or orally Kamala Harris until the very end when she says, I'm Kamala Harris and I approve this ad. In the last 3 seconds, they put her picture up. Is this a good strategy to spend 57 seconds of a minute without the candidate being mentioned or seen?
I think in my mind, it's a pretty good strategy because you don't know perhaps that she wrote it, that she put it out, and it's other people talking. It's the person in the street interview. And I think that people are looking at surrogates. And I think it's a pretty good strategy. She has put out a lot of ads that blend bio and hard-hitting things about Donald Trump. One thing that I've seen here in North Carolina is you have a lot of ads that incorporate the candidate's own words, some with Kamala Harris, some with Donald Trump. And I think that that's very effective when you look at some of those, and they're selective, they're out of context, but is that going to make a difference?
Well, in fact, that's the way they sell soap. They do focus groups and say they talk to people who use the product, and then they use the words that the people who use the product use in their commercials because it resonates that way. Okay, let's flip the coin. Here's a Trump ad going after Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris is killing the American dream.
Kamala Harris claims to support the middle class, but across the board, the middle class suffers under Kamala Harris's radical policies and agendas. Gasoline, electricity, airfare, groceries, housing, car insurance, and even school lunch costs have surged under Kamala Harris.
Starting on day one, we will defeat inflation quickly and we will make America affordable again. We're getting your prices way down. I will cut your energy costs in half. We will make America the dominant energy producer in the world by far.
We will create the biggest, greatest, and strongest middle class in the history of our country. In short, it will be a national economic renaissance.
It's time for the working man and woman to finally catch a break. We are going to bring back the American dream bigger, better, and stronger than ever before.
A television commercial. It starts with a video of Trump speaking at a rally and features his voice throughout the spot. There is no doubt who's responsible for this ad. It shows the rising price of all the products mentioned by the announcer that you just heard. And then it features Trump making promises about the future. He offers no specifics, but it's clearly aimed at the middle class, who are the Democrats' bread and butter. This is a kind of a split ad, unfavorable against Kamala Harris at the top, but offering solutions at the end by the candidate. Can this, Michael, be effective?
Well, it could be, primarily, I think, because of what the message was about, which is economic issues. And so Donald Trump started the general election campaign in the summer, or the sort of the real, you know, beginning of the general election campaign, talking about immigration and public safety. And that seems to be the thing that he loves to talk about on the stump. And obviously in the debate was really focused on those issues. But I suspect that the campaign realizes that this election will turn on the issues that are in this spot, which is prices, inflation, the economy, middle class, jobs, housing, energy costs. And so that's why you see that issue throughout this ad. It's the message that is most likely to resonate with swing voters. And I think that they realize that.
One of the key factors in the Harris spot that Susan mentioned was the fact that they had kind of a man on the street comment. Oh, these were not men on the street. These were people in the former Trump administration. But that's one of the approaches that Josh Stein has been taking in his race for governor, having people speak about his opponent and not him speaking about them.
Mark Robinson has a problem with women.
Women are not supposed to be leading the charge. It's supposed to be men leading the charge.
He's attacked victims of domestic violence and sexual assault.
He doesn't trust us or respect us.
Abortion in this country is not about protecting the lives of mothers. It's about killing a child because you aren't responsible enough to keep your skirt down.
It's not your body anymore. It's not your body.
Mark Robinson must never be our governor.
Robinson has run his share of ads critical of Stein, but in this one, he takes a different approach.
30 years ago, my wife and I made a very difficult decision. We had an abortion.
It was like this silent pain between us that we never spoke of.
It's something that stays with you forever.
That's why I stand by our current law, and it provides common sense exceptions for life of the mother, incest, and rape, which gives help to mothers and stops cruel late-term abortions. When I'm governor, mothers in need will be supported.
So, Steve, given all the other things swirling around Robinson at the moment, do we need a negative ad from Josh Stein anymore? And can Robinson counter this negative press with something in his advertising?
I don't think he can counter at all because he doesn't have any more money and no one is going to help him. So, you know, I think his campaign is over. And you know, going back to the ad that you played earlier, the skirt ad, right? I think that will be remembered. We talk about, you know, Susan talked about the Jesse Helms hands ad. I think the can't keep your skirt down ad will kind of be remembered as a just devastating commercial against Mark Robinson. I mean, it was his own words. It's fair. There's nothing out of bounds about it. But you saw in the polling that he had always kind of trailed Stein, but by a reasonable margin. And then when that ad started circulating, his numbers really started to slide into the double digits, and now they just keep getting lower and lower.
So I have 2 minutes left. I haven't gotten a single text from any of these campaigns that we've been talking about this morning, but I know that people are getting texts on their phones, and people pay a lot of money to put those texts on those phones. But Michael, are they effective? And because if we get annoyed, we can simply block the number.
I've done that. I blocked most of the numbers that I get. I think they're most the campaigns realize getting people on the phone, having them answer the phone, having them open the door is harder and harder these days. And so text messages, even if you don't know if somebody saw it or engaged with it, is likely to be seen. And so if you can send someone a text that says, and you know, in two sentences, here's some message about the campaign, you need to vote, you know, they know who they're sending it to, they know who how engaged they have been previously in the campaign. You can get an impression inside that person's head that might make a difference. And of course, if you get it in front of a vast number of people, a certain small percentage may click on it and donate some money as well. So it probably is worth the effort.
Susan, I got a minute left. Most political ads end with the statement, I'm the candidate and I approve this ad. But how much input, how much control does the candidate have over the message being put out by their media arm?
Oh, you know, it's a sham. It's a veneer. Very rarely does a political action committee put an ad out that they don't think is consistent with the message that the candidate wants, consistent with the image, consistent with the frame. And so there's not much of a difference. And just if you look at it, you've got to look at the frequency of the ad, as well as what I don't know, is there a saturation point? When do you say, I've seen that ad enough, I don't need to see it anymore?
That is the danger, I suppose. People just tune you out, whether it's on radio or television, newspaper, print, other platforms, etc. I had to truncate this conversation. I'm very sorry, but it was interesting. Steve Harrison, WFAE News, Susan Roberts from Davidson College, and Michael Friends from Bowdoin College, and the co-director of the Wesleyan Media Project.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.